Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. If someone's in the back, could they take a look in the basket to see if we have any other announcements? Because I have very few in front of me. My name is Rick Recking. I'm a member of the Society and also part of the Program Committee. I'm the presider this morning. We welcome you to Prairie. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted and open-minded place. Let me get to the right place here, and we'll there it is. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you, no matter what your age or abilities or inabilities. Later in the service, I'll ask you to introduce yourself as a visitor or guest to Prairie, or a returning friend, so that we may get to know you a little bit better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. This morning, this small congregation is going to be blessed with a really special presentation by Robin Proud, our own member. And I'm sorry that it's just not crammed. Looks like we've got a pretty good crowd here, but not the one I was hoping for. For announcements, the Prairie's Women's Group will meet next Saturday in the annex next door, that White House. Brunch usually begins about 9:30 a.m. All women associated with Prairie are welcome. Please bring any food or drink to share and see Ann Urbanski. There she is, if you have any questions. One of the announcements on the right-hand side of the program mentions that if you'd like a short-term volunteer job, you can see me to be the person that assigns people to the circle dinner suppers, an activity that we run during the course of the program year, and we'll probably get into that in late September or October. With that, I'll turn it over to Robin Proud for our opening words.
For the beauty of the earth, this spitting blue-green ball, yes, Gaia, mother of everything, we walk gently across your back to come together again in this place, to remember how we can live, to remember who we are, to create how we will be. Gaia, our home, the lap in which we live, welcome us. And our first hymn is number 138.
Thank you.
For our chalice lighting, we have responsive reading that I just couldn't resist because it was perfect for my topic. So it's number 530, and I'll read the plain part and you'll read the italicized part. Out of the stars in their flight, out of the dust of eternity, here have we come. Stardust and sunlight, mingling through time and through space.
Out of the stars have we come, out from time, out of the stars have we come.
Time out of time before time in the vastness of space, Earth spun to orbit the sun, Earth with the thunder of mountains newborn, the boiling of seas.
Earth formed by sun, lit by sunlight, this is our home, out of the stars have we
mystery, hidden in mystery back through all time. Mystery rising from rocks in the storm and the sea.
Out of the stars, rising from rocks and the sea, kindled by sunlight on earth, arose life.
Ponder this thing in your heart, ponder with awe. Out of the sea to the land, out of the shallows came ferns.
Out of the sea to the land, up from darkness to light. Rising to walk and to fly, out of the sea trembled life.
Ponder this thing in your heart, life up from sea, eyes to behold, throats to sing, mates to love.
Life from the sea, warmed by sun, washed by rain, life from within, giving birth, grows to love.
This is the wonder of time, this is the marvel of space. Out of the stars swung the earth, life upon earth rose to love.
This is the marvel of life, rising to see and to know. Out of your heart, cry wonder, sing that we live.
All right, and now we have a story for all ages, so if those who are young, however you define that, would like to come up for the story. Move this down. Now, this story does not have any pictures. I think there's some more young people back there. Any more want to come up? This story was written in 1951, which is before you were born. It's actually even before I was born. But the person who wrote it wondered what life would be like 200 years later in 2150-something. And he tried to imagine what it would be like. He thought that maybe kids would have some kind of learning machines. So the story is called The Fun They Had. Margie even wrote about it that night in her diary. On the page marked May 17th, 2155, she wrote, "Today, Tommy found a real book. It was very old. The pages were yellow and crackly. And it was awfully funny to read words that stood still instead of moving the way they're supposed to on a screen, you know. And then when they turned back to the page before, it had the same words on it that it had when they read it the first time. Gee," said Tommy, "what a waste. I guess when you're through with the book, you just throw it away." Margie said, "Where'd you find this?" "In my house," he said, "in the attic." "What's it about?" "School." Margie was scornful. "School? What's there to write about school? I hate school." Margie had always hated school, but now she hated it more than ever. The mechanical teacher had been giving her test after test in geography, and she had been doing worse and worse, until her mother had shaken her head and sent for the county inspector. He came out and took the teacher apart. Margie had hoped he wouldn't know how to put it together again, but he knew how. And after an hour or so, there it was again, large and black and ugly, with the big screen where the lessons were. The part she hated the most was the slot where she had to put her homework and test papers. She always had to write them out in a punch code they made her learn when she was 6 years old. And the mechanical teacher calculated the mark in no time. The inspector said, "It's not your daughter's fault. The geography sector was geared too quick." Margie was disappointed. She had been hoping they would take the teacher away. They had once taken Tommy's teacher away for a month because the history sector had blanked out. So now she said to Tommy, why would anyone write about school? Tommy said, it's not our kind of school, stupid. This is the old kind of school they had hundreds of years ago. Margie said, well, I don't know what kind of school they had all that time ago. She looked at the book over his shoulder and said, well, anyway, they had a teacher. Sure, they had a teacher, said Tommy, but it was a man. A man? How could a man be a teacher? Well, he just told the boys and girls things and gave them homework and asked them questions. A man isn't smart enough, said Margie. Sure he is. My father knows as much as my teacher. Margie wasn't prepared to dispute that. She said, I wouldn't want a strange man in my house to teach me. Tommy screamed with laughter. You don't know much, Margie. The teachers didn't live in the house. They had a special building and all the kids went there. Margie said to Tommy, can I read the book some more with you later? Maybe, he said. He walked away whistling. Margie went into the schoolroom. It was right next to her bedroom, and a mechanical teacher was on and waiting for her. The screen was lit up, and it said, today's arithmetic lesson, addition of proper fractions. Please insert yesterday's homework. Margie did it with a sigh. She was thinking about the old schools they had when her grandfather's grandfather was a boy. All the kids from the whole neighborhood came laughing and shouting in the schoolyard, sitting together in the schoolroom, going home together at the end of the day. They learned the same thing so they could help each other and talk about it. And the teachers were people. Yeah. The mechanical teacher was flashing on the screen. When we add the fractions 1/2 and 1/4, Margie was thinking about how the kids must have loved it in the old days. She was thinking about the fun they had. That's our story.
We have a time now to share our joys and concerns. Someone has a microphone, I hope. Penny, are you going to walk around with it?
No.
Could you wait for a microphone?
Got back from a wonderful trip to New York where we had Eric and Nina and Katrina with us at the New York Gift Show, which was really fun, and got to see two theatrical performances, and that made me think of the fact that I have two tickets to King Lear this Thursday at APT for $25 each, so if you would like to go, let me know, and I will throw in a free CD of the APT Talkback to go for King Lear.
I wanted to share with you that two of our members have been in and out of hospital this week that are in my caring group. Donna Murdoch has had some health difficulties, and so I've been in and out of the hospital with her. And Ori Laux has had a recurrence of his multiple myeloma. His cancer. And is having a procedure done tomorrow, and they'll be doing assessments and figuring things out from there. So you can keep in touch with me if you want more. Oh, there are cards for both of them on the table in the lobby. If you sign those, I'll get those to them.
Hi, Dr. Pease had an appearance at 10 o'clock on Friday in the Mitch Hanks show. And one of the congregation is outside said he already heard me. I've come back from Denmark, and my website exploded after Denmark. Denmark is now at the top of the list of foreign countries on my WordPress website after that experience from coming from nowhere. And just yesterday, I got a special recognition award from the west side, West Suburban, Chicago, faith-based peace initiative. And they get, and all I got for this was this wonderful T-shirt. War, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. You can, yeah.
Thank you. Yes.
And on the way down, unbelievably, we ran into this peace hat at the PDQ in Monona, of all places. So we've had a great time.
Great.
Last week or so.
Thank you.
Well, we know we have a lot of wonderful artists. Some of them are a little on the hidden shy side, and a lot of people have collections of art. So our joy is that we've been enjoying this photography work by members, and the sad part is we have to take it down this week, but that means I need to have this much more artwork to put back up. So if anybody, the theme is going to be animals. So if anyone has personal art they've done, sculpture, painting, ceramics, anything to do with animals, or have artwork you've collected that you'd be willing to have sit here for a couple months, please let me know.
Marilyn and I both studied this wall, and we really enjoyed it, so here's your last opportunity.
I had a tradition at my work that when it was your birthday, you brought treats to work, and you provided the treats to your co-workers. So I'm retired now, but I brought treats this morning because today's my birthday.
Happy birthday.
Patty sort of encouraged me to get up here, I guess, by her announcement. On Wednesday, I got together with some old friends from the investment board and had a special food and layout. And Thursday, went to the Dane County Volunteers picnic and they had lots of food. And Friday, we went to help feed for a special dinner at Allied people and had lots of food left over. And Saturday, we went to the Moses picnic, lots of food. And today, I was thinking, maybe I can lose some of those 4 pounds I've been here.
I think I just missed my opportunity to put up a joy and Salina candle for each of those.
Yeah.
So I'll do one for all those spoken and unspoken. Now's the time for our main presentation today. Prairie's been fortunate for the last 15 or 20 years to have Robin Proud as a member of our society. And she's brought to us many enjoyable Sunday mornings, usually presenting in another face or another character. But today she's going to bring us some of her own observations about science fiction. So I turn it over to Robin Proud.
Thanks, Rick. It just seems like I've been here that long. We actually came in 2002, but that's 14 years, so. But before that, we belonged to a group about this size with very similar temperament in the Twin Cities, and that was since 1979, so. When most people think about science fiction, they generally think of it as something lightweight, entertaining, enjoyed by young men living in their parents' basements. But when I thought of people at Prairie, it's mostly women. I thought of Anna Bansky, Nivina Smith, who I'm sorry is not here, and Don Hazlett, apparently another fan, and some of the rest of you. And at heart, science fiction is all about asking what if. Therefore, it gives us access to some of the biggest questions that humans have been asking since the beginning of time, such as where did we come from? Where are we going? What is the best way to live? Or what does it mean to be human? As you use in our free and responsible search for truth and meaning, which is a fourth principle, These are the same questions we often ask. And a couple of years ago when teaching Sunday school, the group I had was in about fifth to seventh grade. The curriculum was called Riddle and Mystery, and each week was focused on one of those big questions. This affinity between science fiction and UUism might explain why a number of famous writers in this genre considered themselves Unitarians or humanists. So today I'll just talk a little bit about some big questions in science fiction and a couple of famous authors. So two caveats to start with. I'm not an expert on science fiction. Some of you are probably more so, and I will hope to hear from you after my remarks. But some of you know I read a lot, so I've read some science fiction. And the second thing is that I'll be considering science fiction today, but not its cousin fantasy. They're often lumped together in bookstores and lists. One definition I found was that straight literary fiction shows things that could happen. Fantasy shows things that can't happen, such as magic or dragons. Science fiction shows things that haven't happened yet, such as travel to another planet or cyborgs. However, while dragons are the province of fantasy, if an author posits that dragons are created by scientific breeding, or if they're a type of complex robot, now we're in the realm of science fiction. Although writers in the eras of the Bible and ancient Greece and Rome and other civilizations always had stories about monsters and gods, what we generally think of as science fiction arose at the time when science itself became a popular concept. An early writer who didn't know she was a pioneer was Mary Shelley, who famously penned Frankenstein when she was 21. It was a wet summer, and her companions, Percy Shelley and Lord Byron, decided everyone should write a ghost story for entertainment. Now, if you've actually read Frankenstein, you'll know that it's far from the popular vision of the movies. It employed the new scientific idea of galvanism, which was electric current, to bring the monster to life. And the monster, far from being cruel and destructive, is really an abandoned child trying to make his way in the world. Now, interesting thing about that is that Mary Shelley's mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, who is on our list of famous UUs, who I may talk about someday, she was a very forward-thinking feminist. But she died within a month after her daughter, Mary, was born. So, like Frankenstein's monster, that daughter was given life and then left alone in the world, and she wrote a story about that. It's not necessarily a coincidence. But there are two big questions that this novel addresses. One is, what is it to be human? And is technology a force for good or evil? That is, just because we can do a thing, should we do it? Well, we're seeing that a lot these days with a lot of issues about adapting genes, or there was an article recently about growing organs in pigs or other animals for transplant to humans. So these are the same questions that we are still asking. The two writers of the 19th century who created the genre as it's really known today were Jules Verne and H.G. Wells. Many of their ideas became reality. Submarines, warfare in the air was described by Wells, and then he lived long enough to see it used deadly practice in World War I and II. The Time Machine, a book that made Wells famous, addresses partly the question, where are we going as a human race, by looking into the future. And after the time that you may remember from the movies where there are two races, he actually does go to the very end of the solar system when the sun winks out. So this question of where are we going was on his mind. The question of where do we come from was of more interest to fiction writers before so much became known about the Big Bang and our origins, but it hasn't stopped generations of writers from famously submitting to editors over and over stories like this. So don't submit this if you want to write a science fiction story. In the story, most of humanity is wiped out by a war, plague, or other disaster. At the end, the two remaining figures turn to each other to introduce themselves, and their names are Adam and Eve. Well, early science fiction around 1900 was often very positive. It described societies where machines and biological advancements gave people freedom and equality. But after World War I and continuing after World War II, visions of the future tended to be dystopias. Two classics from the 20th century are 1984 by George Orwell, which is a vision of a completely totalitarian state, and Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, where entertainment and drugs keep people distracted while those in power accomplish their ends. So you might want to discuss which of these we are most close to. And of course, both of these kinds of societies do exist today in some places. Utopias and dystopias address the question of what is the best way to live, and that relates to several of our principles. The second principle is about justice, equity, and compassion. The fifth principle is about the right of conscience and the democratic process. And the sixth principle is about the goal of world peace. So all of those are addressed when we start to create how society could be. There are many more famous dystopias than utopias. This is partly because utopias are rather boring. If everyone is happy and equal, there's no conflict or drama. Also, one person's utopia may be another person's nightmare. Anytime conformity is required, or sacrifice of a person to a group, some people will find that intolerable. And it's a reasonable question whether a utopia can exist without its dark side. Here's an example from the children's book, The Giver. There's a well-ordered society where people never have to feel pain or sorrow. It turns out they also don't feel joy, fear, or other emotions, and they don't even see colors. And they keep their society going by secretly eliminating the old and the infirm. A famous story on this subject is called The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce that last word, by Ursula Le Guin. She describes a town on festival day with bright colors, music, and happy people. But then she shows us a locked room where one child is kept barely alive in misery and filth. Somehow, this child must be treated in this way in order for the rest of the society to maintain its happy existence. As the young people of the town grow up, they are taken to see this child and learn its importance. Often they are horrified, but soon they justify the status quo by various rationalizations. They manage to forget that their happiness depends on someone's misery. Yet there are always a few, young people or older, who choose to leave, not knowing what else is out there, and to walk away from Omelas. This story is as much philosophy as science fiction. It was written in 1973, and you could say it describes a world that has always existed where some benefit from the suffering of others through slavery or colonialism. In 2016, we have cheap clothing and electronics because many people, including children, work in miserable conditions to produce them. And then they're exposed to toxins while scavenging in garbage dumps to earn a minimal living. So can we walk away from modern society? Science fiction is sometimes an early indicator of social concerns. For instance, let's look at environmentalism, our seventh principle, about the interconnected web of which we are a part. In the 1950s and 60s, the scary elements of science fiction stories tended to be aliens, monsters, or robots run amok. But starting in the 1970s, there were many novels and stories depicting wastelands resulting from human activities. The Earth is overpopulated or underpopulated, or the Earth is too hot, too cold, too polluted to sustain life. Terms like the greenhouse effect and global warming were used in fiction before they were widely incorporated into the general vocabulary. Even the nonfiction Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, the one book that had the most influence on the environmental movement, it begins with a fictional evocation of a future Earth where no birds sing. This powerful image, captured in the title, grab the attention of society. Another area of social concern where science fiction led was in questioning gender roles. Up until the 1970s, this was a man's genre. Some women wrote in the field under men's names, such as Andre Norton and James Tiptree Jr., who were both actually women. But of all the genres, this is one where roles could be questioned. A pioneer in feminist science fiction was Ursula Le Guin, Her book, The Left Hand of Darkness, depicts a race that has both male and female characteristics, assuming an appropriate role at the time of mating. Marge Piercy wrote a book called He, She, and It that describes a future where much of the world lives in crowded cities controlled by industry, and they're barely staving off the chaos that exists outside. But there's also a communal society run by women that is egalitarian and peaceful. Another book is The Door into Ocean by Joan Slonczewski. That is about a female society that lives in harmony with its watery surroundings. When a male-dominated group attacks, these people are so dedicated to their peaceful principles that they allow their children to die rather than fight back. And in the end, they win. Margaret Atwood in The Handmaid's Tale describes the opposite, a world where religious fundamentalists have removed women's rights. At that time, when she wrote it, 1985, she said that everything she depicted in it actually existed somewhere in the world. Well, all of these science fiction novels have a lot to say about gender, society, politics, and religion. The great thing about this genre is that you can have anything as your way to organize society. This was a very broad introduction to a few themes of science fiction, and that was mostly in England and the United States. Well, in recent years, writers in Asia, Africa, and Latin America are adding their voices to this genre. So let's look at just a few practitioners of this genre. Several of the most famous science fiction writers were UUs, notably Isaac Asimov, whose story I read, and Ray Bradbury. Asimov was a prolific writer in many fields. There's something about how he wrote something in every category of the Dewey Decimal System. But he was mostly famous for his classic space and robot stories. Ironically, he was afraid of flying. He would travel by car or train. And Ray Bradbury also wrote widely. Among his works are The Martian Chronicles and Fahrenheit 451. And the short story, A Sound of Thunder, which some of you may remember us having dramatized here a few years ago with our young people, where stepping on a butterfly in the past changes history. Now, it's interesting that time travel is classified as science fiction rather than fantasy, so someone must think it could be invented. And today I'll just talk about two UUs who made their name in a field that was once science fiction itself, television. Rod Serling, like many of the sci-fi pioneers, was from a Jewish family. As a child, he put on plays. He was a great talker, and I identified with this one. Supposedly on a two-hour family car trip, the rest of the family remained silent to see how long it would take Rod to notice. He never did notice the other's silence, but talked nonstop through the whole trip. In high school, he was a debater and editor of the school newspaper. When he graduated in 1943, he immediately joined the Army and trained as a paratrooper. In the Pacific, he belonged to squads that lost half their men, and he witnessed friends being killed right next to him. The randomness of death stuck with him, along with nightmares. He said, "I turned to writing to get it off my chest." He went into broadcasting originally as an actor and writer for radio. And then he wrote TV dramas back in the time when there were live dramas. One that he wrote that some of you may be old enough to remember what, and that won awards, was Requiem for a Heavyweight. But political subjects were off limits, according to the network and the sponsors. However, when he got his own show, The Twilight Zone, which was supposedly about fantastical places and situations, he often included topics that were actually commentaries on American society, such as racism. While some episodes of The Twilight Zone were standard horror fare, like evil children who can control a town or the hitchhiker who turns out to be someone who died years ago, others had strong messages. Serling himself wrote a number of the episodes, and here are two famous examples. The monsters are due on Maple Street. In a small town, people see a strange light, and then odd things start happening, such as power going on and off. Someone says that aliens have landed and are hiding among them. People start to suspect each other. And eventually, a panicked mob rampages through town, smashing buildings and shooting each other. At the end, we cut to the aliens on a hill above town, where they comment on how easy it was to stir up humans by simply turning their power on and off a few times. Taking over Earth will be a snap, as the Earthlings do it for them. In 1960, this was not long after the McCarthy era. And The Obsolete Man was written by Serling and starring Burgess Meredith. Now, this is not my favorite Twilight Zone of all time with Burgess Meredith, which is the one where he's a book lover who never has time to read. So he goes into the bank vault for his break. Meanwhile, the world is destroyed. And there he is left with all the books, but then he breaks his glasses. So, however, this is a different one that Meredith started. A lot of famous actors were in some of these early ones. Robert Redford, for instance, William Shatner. Yeah. So in this one, The Obsolete Man, Meredith again plays a book lover. So Serling himself introduced the episode, as he often did. He said, "This is a future that might be an extension of what has been in the old world, using new technology for the destruction of freedom. The setting is a stark, empty room with towering doors. And at a high desk, a chancellor declares that his character, Mr. Wordsworth, is obsolete. The state has banned all books, so there is no need for a librarian, so he will be eliminated. It has also banned religion." Now, it's interesting, Serling definitely was a humanist, but here he made his hero a spokesman for religion, or at least for freedom of belief. The librarian faces his death while reading the Bible. And at the end, the chancellor himself is declared obsolete by the next chancellor. Rod Serling's final statement is right from the UU first principle. He comes back on himself and says, "Any state that fails to recognize the worth and dignity and rights of man is obsolete." The other TV writer I'll mention today is Gene Roddenberry, creator of Star Trek. Sorry. He grew up reading science fiction and became a pilot. Like Serling, he served in World War II, and later he was working with the Los Angeles Police Department in that capacity. He became an advisor to TV shows and ended up switching to writing. He won an award for an episode of Have Gun, Will Travel, a Western. He was asked to write a series called Riverboat, set in 1860s in Mississippi, but he refused to write it with no black characters, as he was requested to do. One of his ideas for a series was about a multi-ethnic cruise on an airship, but the networks weren't ready for that. However, when the setting was moved to the future and outer space, the cast could include black, Asian, Russian, and even a non-human character, Mr. Spock. Other writers worked on scripts, though Roddenberry was often involved. The ratings were not very good, but those who were fans were enthusiastic, initiating letter writing campaigns to renew the series. After the third season, the show was pushed to 10 p.m. Friday night to make room for a show called Laugh-In. As you may know, Star Trek reruns were a constant hit in syndication, and anyone associated with the show was welcome at fan conventions. Roddenberry also worked on some of the upcoming the movies that succeeded that. Roddenberry was raised a Southern Baptist, but as an adult, he rejected religion and called himself a humanist. He said, "How can I take seriously a God image that requires that I prostrate myself every 7 days and praise it? That sounds to me like a very insecure personality." He felt that current Earth religions would be extinct in the future, and he kept them out of his sci-fi world. And of course, he used the sci-fi universe to make points about current culture. For instance, there are messages of tolerance and inclusion, starting with a diverse cast. Supposedly, the actress Nichelle Nichols, who played Lieutenant Uhuru, found the role ridiculous and wanted to quit. But Martin Luther King specifically urged her to stay as a beacon of hope for black viewers, where here she was a professional woman in this drama. The episode, "Let That Be Your Last Battlefield," features a planet where some people are black on the right side and white on the left, and others are the opposite. Each group insists that his race is the preferred one, and that the others are too inferior to be worth negotiating with. Mr. Spock recommends they apply logic, like Vulcans do, but these adversaries prefer to destroy their planet. So if there are Star Trek fans among you, you'll probably have many other examples to share, either from the original series or one of the several spin-offs. Now, at this point, you still may be thinking outer space and creepy morality tales just aren't my thing, so I'd like to close with a reminder of a book that almost everyone knows. This book was published first as a story in a science fiction magazine, and then it was extended into a novel. And that book is Flowers for Algernon. This is the story of Charlie, who has a low IQ and gets a chance to have an operation that will somehow increase his intelligence. That's really the only science fiction in the book. Part of the genius of the story is that it consists of diaries and writings by Charlie. He starts out with very childish sentences full of misspellings. After his surgery, he rapidly becomes smarter and finally a genius. As a result, he figures out before anyone else that the procedure isn't permanent, that he will relapse to his original state and suffer an early death. So his writings after that point reflect a diminishing of his intelligence, but not of his essentially kind nature. The other striking characteristic of this book is the question we asked earlier: is technology a force for good? As Charlie gets smarter, he realizes that his coworkers in the bakery, who he thought of as friends, were making fun of him. And once he is as smart or smarter than them, they resent him and he has to leave the job. Being smarter does not make him happier. Just in the last few months, there was a real-life parallel to this story. John Elder Robison is a man who has written about growing up with Asperger's. His book is called Look Me in the Eye. Some of you may know that. One thing he lacked was awareness of the emotions of others. He got a chance to undergo brain stimulation in the part of the brain that perceives emotions. When he did this, it worked. He was overwhelmed by how much emotion is out there that he never perceived, and he was surprised by how negative much of it was. He had assumed that normal people were happy and at peace. Now he saw how much fear, worry, and anger others carried, and in fact, he ended up getting divorced because now he saw his wife's depression and could no longer live with that. And just like Charlie, he realized that some of his friends had been mocking him without his realization. So is he better off than before? So questions like these take us from the realm of science fiction to the realm of psychology and philosophy. I hope these few examples will stimulate discussion around the intersection of science fiction and UU principles, and I'd love to hear from you about books, TV shows, or movies that you feel address these big questions. I think we have plenty of time for that. And I wondered if somebody, maybe Bob Park, would like to take down some names like you do at the, or maybe people would like to write these down and pass them to us later if people have suggestions of books.
Or maybe we can take it from the recording.
So comments, suggestions.
Thanks. I'll try not to take too long. I have three different points. First, I just wanted to mention, I recently read an article about Gene Roddenberry in Star Trek. He had originally posed that the captain should be a woman. And that was turned down because no one would believe that. So Uhura, he managed to get a woman on the set as communications officer, secretary. So he did his best, which I appreciated. I wanted to talk about the role of science fiction, I think, in my life, which I was an avid reader from very early on. In elementary school, I would scan for the little symbol that meant science fiction on the side of the book, and I would just pull out everything. And I realized that science fiction plays this role of opening you to all the possible ways we could be. And I found it so heartening, enlarging. It really allows you to imagine how you could be different. So I just think it's a wonderful medium for teaching people about what's possible. My third comment, and then I'll quit, I just wanted to share a little vignette that I think about all the time. And science fiction can and does have a lot of humor in it as well. And some of you have read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and that series. And there's a little piece about where we come from in the third book in that series that some of you may recall. And I can't tell you how often I think and talk about this. The idea is that there is this planet where the sun is going to supernova. And they have three arcs they are going to build so that they can take all of their people to a new planet. And the first arc is Arc A, is all of the intelligentsia, the planners, the thinkers, the creative, you know, force. And Arc C are the people who do things, the people who put things together, the, you know, all the people who actually do the work. And Arc B is everybody else. So all of the middlemen. So they get ready first for Arc B, because of course they never intended to send the other arcs anyway, and there isn't actually any supernova. They just wanted to clear out Arc B. And they program it to crash land on a planet. Ours. That is our origin story.
I just completed recently reading a trilogy by Pierce Brown, who's a popular author these days among people who like to read about interplanetary battles where millions of people die. I don't recommend the books because of the graphic violence, but they do address the question of what is a human, because it looks at the question of what if science, technology, and genetics were used to create a dozen different subspecies of humans who then are essentially enslaved to serve the top group, the golds. They can no longer intermarry because they're not genetically close enough and without special surgery. And if the surgery is performed, then the penalty is death for intermarrying. It's Red Rising, Golden Sun, and Morning Star. They're all available from the library. And they're recent. A book I would recommend is Lucy by Gonzalez, Florence Gonzalez, which was a Chapter Day book a number of years ago, one of the best ones they've done. And the story is about a girl who whose father was a scientist in the Congo working with bonobos, and he manages to create a daughter who's half bonobo and half human, but she looks human, and she enters human society and then is discovered, and what happens, how the far right respond and this sort of thing. It's a very good book, and it's available to lend if someone wants.
So a few things. Let's see. I would recommend Babylon 5. Some of you guys hadn't seen that. It's not only does it present alternative politics, but also alternative religions. Reflecting on science and the divine. If you've ever looked at the Worldwide Telescope, this app by Microsoft, you can view like the entire sky and zoom in on sections of the sky and search for things, and you can find things like galaxies colliding. There's one, like five galaxies colliding that you can look at. Or a field of galaxy clusters where there's like 100 galaxies in one section of the sky all clustered together. And it's so that just fills me with awe, but it's science, you know. And also just the fact that we are the stuff of stars, that the higher metals like carbon that we're made of aren't possible unless a star explodes. And so we come from an exploded star.
I'd like to talk briefly, I hope, about one book and two TV episodes. The book is, I mentioned, I think, when I did my service in June, that I'm kind of a fan of dystopian fiction, especially young adult fiction. And the one that I liked, and I'm not even sure it's dystopian, there's a series, but I haven't managed to read the rest of the books. The author is Scott Westerfeld, I think his last name is, and the book that I read was called Uglies, and it's a society in which when you get to be 15 or 16 years old, they decide if you are attractive enough to belong to the general society. And if you are not attractive enough, they have you undergo a surgery so that basically everybody looks pretty much almost exactly identical. And you know, the girls all look one way and the guys all look another way. And you know, guy like. but if you are not pretty enough, you end up being exiled. And but supposedly you can't choose, but this girl decides right before she's supposed to have the surgery that she doesn't want to do it. She doesn't want to enter into this state of conformity. And so she escapes and she has adventures with these other, quote, uglies out in sort of this wilderness. If you're not one of the pretties, you end up being, you know, in a not a good place physically. So that was an interesting book. But the two TV episodes were two from Star Trek. I'm a firm Star Trek person, and the Star Trek versus Star Wars. Not to say there's anything wrong with Star Wars, but I'm just a Star Trek person. And did watch the original series in real time. And you know, so, but I actually am more of a fan of the later series, especially Star Trek Next Generation and Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And the first female captain was actually in Star Trek Voyager, Catherine Janeway, yes. But the two Deep Space Nine episodes from Next Generation are, one is called The Inner Light, and the other one is called Darmok. And The Inner Light, Jean-Luc Picard has I can't remember all the details of it, but it's one in which he basically sees himself living out a lifetime, and then it turns out he's been sort of like gone for like a couple of minutes, you know. But in his brain, he's living out a lifetime. But Darmok is probably my favorite. Captain Picard is on a planet. He goes on an away mission and he encounters this other being who is humanoid, sort of, but definitely alien. And played by the great Paul Winfield, and they can't communicate because it turns out that this captain, whose name is not Darmok, this captain cannot speak in any language that the universal translator can translate. And so they spend a lot of time on the ship trying to figure out how can Picard communicate with him. And he talks in, it turns out that he talks in metaphors. And it takes them a long time to figure this out. But the point of liking this episode so much is, for me, is that it shows that you have to have patience. And when you meet somebody who is different, the importance of patience and being willing to see that the other person is a valuable individual, even if you can't communicate with them immediately. So.
I just wanted to mention, Robin had said... mentioned time travel and said that some people think that may be a reality. I just wanted to mention a little thing about time travel is a reality. Einstein predicted it, and every one of you today is using technology that involves time travel. It turns out the closer to a heavy body like the Earth you are, the slower time goes. And when there are satellites in distant orbit, time actually travels faster than it does on Earth. The entire GPS system has to account for this. It's a very small fraction, but the GPS satellites actually have to adjust because time is moving faster in space than it is on Earth.
I just wanted to give two recommendations. I love science fiction. I was really excited about coming today. First, my favorite novel is Dune. I don't know if anybody's ever read that. I'm actually going to play the theme song from the movie. I even had it played at my wedding. That's how much I love Dune. So I mean, I don't even know how to give a... It's just read it. It's just beautiful writing and amazing descriptions he gives. The other... I have a movie that I'd recommend. Hopefully you've seen it. Gattaca from the late 90s. Huge themes of just basically the the main character is genetically, you know, incorrect for this future society, and you basically have the Valids, who are designer babies. You've actually make men to be the best they can, but he was, they call him a godchild. He was just born like us, and he's trying to transcend into being a Valid, and it's just all these really deep themes about, you know, what is a person's worth? Is it their genetics? Is it what they can accomplish? It's very, very interesting. So if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. It's called Gattaca. It's got Jude Law in it. Can't go wrong with that.
Well, the prediction that there won't be books, or at least that theme. My sister is a library media specialist in Arcadia, Wisconsin, over, I guess it's east of La Crosse, and where she lives, or I mean, on Alaska, which is near La Crosse. Anyway, she has to work in three different, the high school, the middle school, and the elementary school, because that's what's happening with library media specialists, is they're being phased out, basically. But one of her principals, I don't know whether it's the elementary school, the high school, or whatever, said, you know, you've got to get rid of half of the books that are in the library, because books are a thing of the past, and people can find out, kids can find out everything they need to know on the internet, so get rid of those books.
Now, I thought it was charming that Asimov went as far as to have punch cards, because that was, in 1951, that was already pretty advanced, and a screen. Although, later on, as these things developed, he was not opposed to the use of technology in school. It was just intriguing how, sometimes it's fun to see how people in the past thought the future would be, right? That, yeah. We haven't got our flying cars yet.
Yeah, I remember 1984, and reread George Orwell's book to see, you know, whether it fit the situation, and it did. We had peacekeeper missiles in Europe. We had the number one nuclear weapons contractor spokesperson elected president from, you know, General Electric company, Death Valley days and all that. And black was white and white was black in a number of examples that I can't all think of right now. But at the time, it really seemed to fit George Orwell's 1984 book. So there's a dystopia. For a utopia, just coming back from Denmark, we visited three communes, including Christiana, which was formed in 1971 by taking over some old army barracks. And they operate by consensus vote of the community. And they have 800 adults living there. And recently, the conservative government cracked down on the open sale of marijuana on Pusher Street, and they were back in business that afternoon after the conservative government cracked down and everything. So they continue. The tour guide had been there since 1974, a black man that gave us an excellent tour of Christiania. And so there is a commune very active in the heart of the city of Copenhagen, Denmark.
I just now wanted to share that a real life example now, that using animal tissues, that my sister a year and a half ago had a valve replacement in her heart, and then my brother just this summer had a valve replacement in his heart. My sister got a pig tissue, and my brother got cow tissue.
Thank you all for your observations. Thank you, Robin, very much. Prairie runs on love and money, and we're going to deal with the money part right now. Thank you, Amber, for doing the accompaniment today. theme for Dune? Thank you. Now's the opportunity for our guests and visitors to introduce themselves. I know we have some, so we'd like some. Eileen, would you introduce your guest?
We have a Servais traveler with us this weekend, Barbara Hardesty. Our Servais travelers often come from overseas. She comes from all the way from Florida and Chicago. But it's really, she's also been a Servais host, and it's nice to get to know her and spend some time together this weekend.
Well, welcome. Guess we're set. If you left your hymnals open when you sang 138, you can turn the page. And we're going to do number 139, Wonder Still the World Shall Witness.
Closing words. What we call a beginning is often the end. And to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start from. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. T.S. Eliot. And join us for coffee and treats.